From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. The presidential race is neck and neck in New Hampshire.
We've seen a continuously tightening race pretty much for the last four polls, and this one's no exception. So the race really couldn't be closer in New Hampshire at the moment.
Also on the show today, we continue our coverage of the biggest donors in the fight over lifting the charter school cap. We'll hear from a teachers union.
Question two really threatens the existence of the public school system in Massachusetts, and that's why we're so heavily involved in that.
And across America, some 50 to 80,000 SWAT teams are deployed every year. A new documentary traces the militarization of local police forces.
What purpose are bayonets being given out for?
I can't answer what a local police force would need a bayonet
for. I can give you an answer, none.
Okay.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we will begin today with presidential politics and a new WBUR poll of likely voters in New Hampshire, one of the key battleground states in this current election. With just 5 days to go until Election Day, the poll finds Republican Donald Trump has caught up and is now in a virtual dead heat with Democrat Hillary Clinton. The poll also found a swing towards Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, who now leads Democrat Maggie Hassan by 6 points in a Senate race that could determine the control of the next United States Senate. Joining us now with more is WBUR's senior political reporter, Anthony Brooks. Anthony, it's good to have you.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so let's start with the presidential race. Tell us what the poll found.
Okay, so this poll, very consistent with a number of polls across the country that suggest this presidential race has tightened considerably in the last week or two. And our poll is part of a trend. We've done four polls recently, going back a couple of months when Clinton was up by about 11 points. 6 weeks ago, we had a poll where right after the first debate, she was up by 6 points. 3 weeks ago, up by 3 points. This latest poll, Trump up by 1 point, which is virtually a dead heat. It's within the margin of error.
So we've seen a long-term tightening.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And one of the things that stands out is that voters continue to deeply dislike both candidates. And this is a trend we've seen from the start. Only 37% have a favorable view of Trump, which is up slightly from 3 weeks ago. 36% have a favorable view of Clinton, which is down a bit. So for the first time, Clinton is viewed less favorably than Trump, according to this poll from New Hampshire. And here's Steve Cazella. He's president of Mass Inc. Polling, which conducted the poll.
I mean, when we started the campaign, Trump was the most disliked candidate ever to be nominated by a major party, and Hillary Clinton was the second most disliked. So, you know, this voter distaste for the candidates is not necessarily a new dynamic, but it has not improved at all.
Meghna, the polls have sort of been a little all over the place. Just last week, UNH did a poll that found Clinton up by 7 points, but this afternoon, a new Boston Globe, Suffolk University poll finds that Clinton and Trump are tied in New Hampshire. So that's very much in line with the WBUR poll.
I see. Now, this poll, the WBUR poll, was conducted after FBI Director James Comey really shook up the race last Friday with that news that he's reopening an inquiry into Hillary Clinton's emails. Do we know if that had any effect on these polling results?
Well, it's difficult to answer that with any to be sure about it. I mean, you're right that this the polling happened right after that, between Saturday and Tuesday. What the poll did find is that 85% of the respondents said they had heard a great deal or a fair amount about the story. Now, nobody knows what's in those newly discovered emails or even if they're relevant at all to the investigation, but the story perhaps has fed the narrative that Clinton's got this problem around trust. Here are a couple more statistics from the poll that play into this. A little more than a quarter of respondents, just about a quarter, say Clinton is honest and trustworthy. 70% say she is not. Trump's numbers are slightly better. A little more than a third say he is honest and trustworthy. 60% say he's not. And one more point related to this subject from the poll, which is a reminder of just sort of how grim people feel about this election. Almost 70% believe Trump has done more to divide people than bring them together. Just over half feel that way about Hillary Clinton. And nearly 60% of New Hampshire voters, according to our poll, say the presidential campaign has made our democracy weaker rather than stronger. Pretty grim numbers.
Wow, yeah, we are awash in so much negative sentiment here. But then again, not terribly surprising given the nature of this presidential race. So let's move to the Senate race in New Hampshire. Tell us what the poll found about the race between Senator Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan.
Well, Kelly Ayotte leads, according to our poll, Maggie Hassan by 6 points. And there's a sort of overall shift toward Republicans running statewide in New Hampshire in that Senate race, as well as in the governor's race, where Republican Chris Sununu now leads Democrat Colin Van Ostern by 5 points. So it seems like this movement is being driven by the top of the ticket, where this race remains very close. And consider that there is still a sizable percentage of undecided, 7%. Which means that this race is still kind of could go either way in New Hampshire, according to this poll, and it will come down really to the final days.
7% undecided with just 5 days to go. Oh, my. Well, so I guess that means, Anthony, that the ground game and the get out the vote effort is going to be of supreme importance in New Hampshire's I mean, typically, or at least in elections past, have the Democrats had the advantage there?
Yeah, big time. And this has been a concern among Republicans during this campaign, that Trump has been flying in and out a lot. He's been to New Hampshire 8 times just since the convention. He's coming back tomorrow. He'll be back again on Monday. But his campaign isn't coordinated with other Republican campaigns like Senator Kelly Ayotte's. He doesn't have the kind of field organization that the Democrats have, the kind of get out the vote organization. So here's Andy Smith. He heads the polling center at the University of New Hampshire, who says that there are historical reasons why the Democrats have this big organizational advantage in New Hampshire. Here's what he said.
The Democratic Party for decades or a century had been the minority party in the state and didn't have access to people or financial resources that the Republicans had. And consequently, they had to rely on essentially manpower to try to get voters out to the polls. And they built a very, very good get out the vote operation over the last several decades.
Yeah, so, Magna, consider 2014. Democrats faced losses across the country, but in New Hampshire, Senator Jeanne Shaheen was reelected to the U.S. Senate. Democrat Governor Maggie Hassan, despite being outspent, was reelected governor. And folks up there say that had a lot to do, if not everything to do, with a superior ground game.
Mm. But nevertheless, Anthony, as you said a little earlier, Donald Trump comes to New Hampshire a lot. And I'm seeing here, in fact, that Ivanka Trump is actually in New Hampshire campaigning for her father today. And as you mentioned, Donald Trump himself back in the Granite State tomorrow. And I see that he's even going to be ending his campaign in New Hampshire on Monday.
Right. He's going to be ending it right where he started it, in New Hampshire. And the reason is because he thinks, with these polls tightening, that he can win there. And the fact is, he needs to win there. Clinton still has an advantage on the Electoral College map. Despite this New Hampshire poll, other recent polls suggest she's leading in states like Florida, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, to name a few. If Trump is to win, he needs to win just about every one of those major battleground states and flip a normally blue state like New Hampshire. So those 4 electoral votes could matter. I mean, don't forget 2000, when Al Gore lost New Hampshire, mm-hmm. a state that Democrats thought he should have won. Had he won that, he would have been president, and the dispute in the state of Florida wouldn't have even mattered. Democrats are aware of this, too, and they're not taking New Hampshire for granted. So tomorrow, Chelsea Clinton's going to be in New Hampshire. On Monday, President Obama's going to be in New Hampshire, the same day that Donald Trump will be there.
Wow. Okay. So, Anthony, that's presidential politics. But before I let you go, can we talk about another hard-fought battle? One that went down to the wire.
Oh, yeah.
The 11th hour decider. I mean, one of the things I miss most about having you as my co-host is, who's going to talk baseball?
Well,
we got to talk about the World Series.
We've got to at least mention the Cubs, and I'm glad you asked that question. And, yeah, so I treated myself yesterday to an evening off at a bar in Cambridge. Thank you, McCabe's on Mass Ave. I thought I was going in there for maybe a beer and a couple of innings. I watched the whole
thing. Hours later.
Hours later, after midnight. But what a game. I mean, you know, this was just one of the great game sevens of all time, where it comes down to extra innings. The final at bat, the final batter could have turned it around. It could have gone either way. But the Chicago Cubs, of course, winning after a 108-year drought. And I have to tell you, Magna, I'll confess, I was sort of rooting for Cleveland because of the Terry Francona link. Mm-hmm. I have a soft place in my heart for Terry Francona. But the Cubs, clearly the best team of the season. They deserve the win. And what a fantastic game. And it got me thinking as well about Theo Epstein, another Boston connection, right? He's the president of baseball operations for the Chicago Cubs. He built this world champion. He did the same thing in Boston, 2004, yep, and ended our drought, 86-year drought. And it got me thinking about what he should do next. And I'm thinking, he ought to run for president. Come on, he can bring people together. He can do great deals.
He's a winner.
He did it here in Boston. So Theo Epstein for president coming soon.
You may be onto something. Someone like Theo Epstein, I think that may not be far out of the realm of extreme possibility for stuff he wants to do with his life. But WBR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, and also today our baseball reporter as well. Anthony, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Magna. Thank you.
All right. Well, here's something else that surprised us recently. The other day, we received a tweet from El Planeta, the largest Spanish language newspaper in Massachusetts. And the tweet said, "Our readers are more interested in question 2 and 4 than the presidential race." Of course, the Massachusetts Spanish-speaking community is heavily invested in local issues, so maybe this isn't a surprise. But this is also an election cycle where the national debate over immigration is central to the presidential race. So joining us now to tell us more is Javier Marin. He is founder and publisher of El Planeta. Javier, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Magna.
So tell us more. At what point in time did you see that your readership was more focused on the charter school question and the marijuana legalization question than perhaps the presidential race?
Well, our editorial board have been working pretty hard to invite and motivate the Latino register to vote and then to vote. Unfortunately, that turnout doesn't look that promising, and even looks lower than the Obama elections.
Really?
And there are certain reasons. I mean, a little fear for that frontal attack of an offensive attack from Trump, and deception from the Democratic promises of immigration reform, for the lack of mentioning the immigration topics during the debates. But surprisingly, there have been a lot of information on the questions, the question number 2 and question number 4, and a lot of interaction with our readers have been about it. And so we have been seeing a lot of excitement about coming and vote for these two questions with more emphasis than the presidential race.
That is absolutely fascinating. Okay, so tell us a little bit then about the dialogue you've been having with your readers. Mm-hmm. What are they saying about the charter school cap question, question 2?
Question 2, both questions, I would say that they're very divided, the community, with very extreme different opinions. I mean, I can mention several readers that love their charter school where their kids are, and some others that are frustrated because their kids haven't been able to get into those schools. And when they are more informed about questions too, you could see their motivation and their excitement about it. And the other side, you know, public schools defenders and promoters. It's a huge community that attends the public schools are always, you know, in favor of that question. But there have been a lot of interaction.
They're opposed to the question. Yeah. So interesting. So, but there's a pretty close divide there in the Spanish-speaking community over question 2. Mm-hmm. That mirrors the divide across the state. It's such a hard-fought battle as well. And what about? Oh, go ahead.
That it could make a difference, because I don't think the both campaigns are taking note of the potential number of voters of these questions, and because of the excitement that we have seen lately with a lot of information about the question 2 and question 4, we could see that maybe that would create a different impact on the results.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious, though, because was it this week the Yes on Two folks one of the groups that is in support of charter school, lifting the charter school cap, ran a big ad in El Planeta as well. So there is some outreach to
from both campaigns, yes.
Okay. So tell us about what the dialogue has then been over question four.
That's a very interesting, people are more vocal on that question four. There are some, some religious-driven opinions against question four, but also a lot of in favor relating the issue with crime in communities where Latinos live, the youth. It's a subject that, you know, it matters a lot to the voters. And what our reader says is that distribution of marijuana in the communities where we live, it's creating a lot of crime in teen youth. And that's why people prefer to have the recreational legalized, and that, according to them, it will be
interesting. So I see what you're saying, that many people are in support of legalization because because of the impact in terms of crime and arrests and that aspect of marijuana. But then you also said earlier that you have extremely religiously devout readers who feel the opposite.
Yes.
Okay. And so they're sort of a description of the diversity within the Latino community on this question.
Generational, I would say, as well.
Generational. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so tell us, there's something about is there something about these two questions which, as you're describing, are generating a lot of interest and a lot of excitement to vote, that also tells us about the Latino community's sort of growing influence at the polls in Massachusetts? Like, could there be, you know, could they have an impact on how the outcome of these questions?
Well, I read somewhere that it's a sleeping beast, the Latino vote in Massachusetts, and I still think that it's still sleeping. And the main reason is because the community have been feel manipulated in the past, you know, offering immigration reforms. Now the immigration topic is not even in the debates. And you could see also on the ratings on TV, for the first time, the debates have been live broadcast in the Spanish TV network, Univision. And the ratings have been very low. Mm. The first and second, the third one increased.
Mm. Interesting, because immigration reform per se hasn't really been central in this presidential race. But the idea of the bigger concept of immigration and who should be allowed in and out of the United States, I mean, Donald Trump has... he launched his campaign on that with his talk about the wall on America's southern border, and so that's one of the reasons why it's so interesting to me that you're saying that Massachusetts Latino voters are even given that they're still, it seems, more excited to vote about question two and four, because to a certain degree the issue of immigration is still a very hot button issue in the presidential race, because for example, if I could just turn back to the presidential race with you, just yesterday the Republican National Committee released its first Spanish language television ad for this year's presidential election.
Necesitamos un gobierno que nos beneficie. Vota republicano este 8 de noviembre.
So in that clip, we hear the person saying, let's make government work for us, vote Republican on November 8th. Meanwhile, Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine is fluent in Spanish. He's been making a lot of stops in Latino communities. Here he is just last month addressing parishioners at the Numa Church in Miami.
Buenos días a todos. Estoy bien contento a visitar con ustedes aquí en el Numa Church.
So this isn't really, you're saying this isn't resonating, though, that strongly with Massachusetts Latino voters.
Well, I think what you just heard is a message of, you know, the presidential race paying attention to the Latino community lately.
Uh-huh.
And that's because they need the vote. But I don't think that's creating a good result. It's they're sending a message in our own language, which I think it's awesome. I don't know, it has nothing to do, but I don't know if you noticed yesterday on the World Series, there was one Spanish TV commercial for the first time. So I think that given the importance to the language, it's a good message from the presidential candidates. But again, what I said before, according to our readers, what Trump has done is a frontal attack that has created a fear of not voting for him. But there is not motivation to vote for the other either.
Yeah.
So there is not a natural reaction of anti-Trump, vote for Hillary.
Interesting. And I suppose there's always this, the issue of campaigns and parties speaking at Latino voters rather than speaking about the issues that maybe matter to them.
Exactly.
Well, Javier Marin is founder and publisher of El Planeta, the largest Spanish language newspaper in Massachusetts. So wonderful to have you. Hope to have you back again soon.
Meghna, thank you so much.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the middle of Craig Atkinson's new documentary, we watch as a South Carolina woman's home is raided by the local SWAT team. Armed with long guns, wearing ballistic helmets and bulletproof vests, the team smashes her windows and breaks down the door. The next day, the documentary crew goes back to the home to interview the woman.
First thing I asked, y'all looking for a terrorist? Y'all think a terrorist in here? Because that's the kind of feeling that I had. They're looking for something really strong, really important. I mean, government stuff.
Well, what they were looking for was drugs. And what they found was what they called a, quote, personal amount of marijuana. That was just one of the 50 to 80,000 SWAT deployments across the country every year. The number was closer to 2,000 back in the 1980s. So that 40-fold increase in SWAT deployments, that's the subject of Atkinson's documentary. It's called Do Not Resist, and it won this year's Best Documentary Award at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it will be screening tonight at the Museum of Fine Arts. Craig Atkinson will also be there on a panel discussion that follows. But first, he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much. Thanks for being interested.
Well, so tell us first, what inspired you to follow this story of the militarization of local police forces?
Sure. My father was a police officer for 29 years outside of the Detroit area, and he was actually a SWAT officer for 13 of those years. He retired in 2002, and I really hadn't thought about anything to do with SWAT or police work until, quite honestly, that I saw the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing, and it was the first time that I had seen the level of equipment that I subsequently found out while making this film was gifted to law enforcement.
Yeah.
After 9/11. The DHS grants of $34 billion piled on to the DOD grant, which was $5 billion. So we're looking at $39 billion, you know, after 9/11. And so my father's era missed that whole wave of funding. So as I'm sitting there watching the aftermath, the Boston Marathon bombing was the first time that I've seen that investment in equipment. And I was curious to know what had happened.
So I guess you're specifically talking about the Watertown manhunt.
Correct.
Where we saw the deployment of all sorts of mm-hmm. very heavily militarized equipment in the search for the Tsarnaevs. Interesting. So before we get further into what you found in your documentary about how those billions of dollars have been put into play, can you tell us a little bit about what your father's experience as a SWAT team member was? What was
sure.
a SWAT team like
sure.
in
well,
the
you know,
decades
his,
past?
His department started a SWAT team in 1989, and that was a response to some of the violence that people were seeing in various communities. The North Hollywood shooting is often referenced, where the two individuals donned body armor, robbed the bank, and police were so ill-equipped that they had to go to pawn shops in order to get the equipment necessary to neutralize that threat. You know, when they formed the SWAT team, it was an era where they would send, you know, a couple officers to a training module for a weekend, and they would come back and be the SWAT commander. So it wasn't regulated. It's not that regulated now. But to give you some context, you know, my father was on SWAT for 13 years. He did 29 search warrants that entire time.
For the whole 13 years?
For the entire time. And, you know, we're going out with SWAT departments or police departments and going out on SWAT raids. And in conjunction with the film, and a similar size department is doing 3 to 4 raids a day, over 200 a year. And so there's just been an absolute significant mission creep, if you will, with the deployment of SWAT. It's almost become a routine part of police work, whereas my dad's era, it was reserved for the most violent, most specific use, and oftentimes was a barricaded gunman or a hostage situation or a very, you know, high-risk entry search warrant. But, you know, as we were going out with the police departments around the country, they kept telling us that it was going to be used for terrorist events and ISIS, but every single time we went out, it was for drug offenses, and you know, I can report that we never found anything. anything. One time it was a gram of weed. One time it was a bowl of weed. But in the process, you know, destroying the home and oftentimes arresting the people and seizing their assets, even though that it was such a small quantity.
Interesting. Well, you in the movie Do Not Resist also include clips. You take us inside how these officers are trained. Mm. And you have a clip of a seminar that's given by Dave Grossman. He's a retired Army lieutenant colonel who teaches both FBI agents and police officers across the country. Here's a little bit of that.
You fight violence. What do you fight it with? Superior violence. Righteous violence, huh? Violence is your tool. Violence is your enemy. Violence is the realm we operate in. You are men and women of violence. You must master it, or it will destroy you, yeah?
And then he goes on and talks about what officers have told him about their experiences on these teams.
Cop says gunfight, bad guys down, I'm alive. Finally get home at the end of the incident, and they all say, the best sex I've had in months. Both partners are very invested in some very intense sex.
Tell us about this.
Well, Dave Grossman has been teaching law enforcement for the last 18 years. Prior to teaching law enforcement, he spent 25 years in the military helping the military improve their kill ratio. So historically speaking, it's very difficult to get humans to kill other humans. The kill ratio in World War II was about 15 to 30%. By Vietnam, it was 90%. And how they got soldiers to kill more was through a process of desensitizing the individual and teaching killing through pop-up targets. So it becomes a conditioned response. And, you know, this may be very effective in you know, surviving a war zone. But, you know, there's 63 million police-citizen interactions every year. And if you're taking that mentality into basic police-citizen interactions, I think we can start to see where there may be issues. It's interesting to point out that Philando Castile, the gentleman who we saw life slip away via Facebook last July, you know, the officer that killed him had attended one of Dave Grossman's seminars. And this is an individual who got pulled over at a traffic stop. There's a four-year-old daughter in the back seat, and he's reaching for his wallet and gets shot six times. It's just very interesting to know that this officer went through that style of training. I can only imagine what if it would have been any different if he had been taught de-escalation training. And I think that that's really what communities are asking of their police officers these days, is more of a de-escalation versus you know, you are men and women of violence.
So you're saying that they are asking or trying to get them to learn more about de-escalation.
Well, I think there's a trend in law enforcement of officers that are recognizing that they're grossly unprepared for, you know, the day-to-day call-outs. I'll say that when, you know, we went on 20-odd ride-alongs, and almost every single call-out that we went out on was a call-out that required the officer to de-escalate the situation. And, you know, I found officers grossly unprepared to de-escalate situations. However, if it turned violent or if it caused for a violent reaction, you know, I saw them very prepared to handle something like that. So, you know, I did see a disconnect between the style of training and what we're actually seeing on a day-to-day basis in the community.
Hmm. Let's talk for another minute about some of the numbers that you were telling us earlier about how much has been spent on the militarization of local police, because there is a scene in the documentary, again, it's called Do Not Resist, that takes place in a city council meeting in Concord, New Hampshire. And members there at the city council meeting vote to actually accept a $250,000 grant, a federal grant, to buy a Bearcat armored vehicle. And a Concord resident tells the council, terrorism works because it makes people irrational and it makes them destroy themselves. So, I mean, this is a city council voting for this. Is a lot of the impulse for escalating the how police are equipped just coming from local citizens and councils themselves?
Well, in this scenario, the DHS basically offers a grant, and that requires a city council vote. And when a police department approaches the city council saying, hey, would you like a $250,000 for free to help protect officers, it's very hard for elected officials to go against that. In that particular meeting, you know, there was very compelling testimony from citizens saying, hey, this is, we would rather not have this in our community, but the city council voted 11-4 and got the Bearcat anyway. So again, you have citizens speaking out against that, and it's just very hard for elected officials to go against something that's earmarked for officer safety.
Mm. And there's also the question of how closely, if at all, usage of this equipment is tracked, right?
Yes, there's actually no tracking data as for how and when and why this equipment is being used. There was one state that required it, and that was Maryland, and that's only because the mayor of Berwyn Heights, Maryland, had his home raided by mistake, wrong door entry, and his dog was killed. And because it happened to someone in power, he moved it through the legislation and was able to get reporting statistics from 2010 to 2014. It came up on a ballot initiative in 2014, and they dropped it off of it. So there's no longer any reporting statistics nationwide for how SWAT is deployed.
Well, I want to play a little clip that in support of that, because you do have a scene of a Senate meeting on the police use of military equipment. It takes place in 2014. And in this clip, we're going to hear Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri questioning Alan Estevez of the Department of Defense and Brian Kamoy of the Department of Homeland Security.
I want to make sure that the record is clear. Do any of you now have any policy that requires you to track any kind of usage data for the equipment you're providing that is considered military grade? Yes or no?
No.
No.
Not good.
Not good.
Not good. You know, it was a very compelling scene, and I can say that while I was filming it, I got a surge of patriotism, you can almost say, because here are elected officials trying to bring basically the military-industrial complex to task. And during the exchange, I thought our elected officials were making very compelling points. But, you know, fast forward 8 or 9 months later when we're looking for any type of reforms, and there weren't any, and nothing came of that meeting. So it was, you know, disheartening to see that despite our elected officials trying to bring these groups to task, they weren't able to. So it begs the question, well, who's in charge?
Mm-hmm. You know, as you probably well know, the ACLU did a report, I believe this year, about the number of people who had been killed, innocent people who had been killed during some of these SWAT raids. One of them that they talked about happened in 2013 in Framingham, Massachusetts, where Yuri Stamps, a gentleman named Yuri Stamps, was lying on the ground, and he was in his home, and he was shot by an officer during a raid because the officer actually lost his balance and tripped and shot Mr. Stamps and killed him. And it turns out, in fact, that the Framingham police chief, Stephen Carl, actually disbanded the department's SWAT team two and a half years after the shooting of Mr. Stamps. And also just in Revere, not that long ago, we had another swatting of a house of Moroccan immigrants. And the question is, why were they even called there to begin with? So, I mean, that's sort of a little background of what's been happening in Massachusetts. But let me ask you, you've shown this documentary to members of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. What's their response?
Well, you know, I could say, well, from my own family, I showed it to my father, and he was stunned to see that SWAT had become a routine part of police work. I mean, every single felony search warrant in the St. Louis County area is served by the SWAT team, and you can think of plenty of felony search warrants that don't require a SWAT team. They were raiding homes for code enforcement. Someone didn't pay their gas bill. I mean, we've seen around the country.
A SWAT team.
Correct. And we've seen around the country SWAT teams going in for student loans being not paid. We saw Gibson guitars being raided for using illegal rare wood. And so, you know, for my father, who came from an era of 3,000 SWAT raids a year, and now we're up between somewhere 50,000 and 80,000, he was stunned to see the frequency in which SWAT is deployed. We also had an opportunity to show the NYPD, essentially, at the John Jay Criminal Justice College. And it's a feeder school for the NYPD. Over 300 officers were in attendance. Many got up and said, "Thanks so much for making this film. It reflects reality." There was a SWAT commander who immediately got up and tried to put some distance between what the NYPD does and what Dave Grossman teaches, and I thought that was very interesting. So I do see.
But when they say it reflects reality, is it that is it a reality they approve of, or a reality that they want to, you know, stand down from?
That's a great question. You know, I see a lot of officers trapped in the middle, where they are working hard to change the culture of their department, but, you know, just like the community who's been trying to explain this for decades, you know, these group of officers have a hard time going against a very closed-in, very insular culture. So we're almost providing an example of what many of them in law enforcement have been speaking about.
Well, Craig Atkinson is director of the new documentary Do Not Resist. It's about the militarization of local police. It's screening tonight at the Museum of Fine Arts through November 26th, and there's also a panel discussion tonight featuring Craig, the Boston Police Camera Action Team, and the National Center for Race Amity, and the ACLU Massachusetts. We've got information about that at our website, RadioBoston.org. Craig, thank you so very much for coming in today.
Thank you for your interest. I appreciate it.
Well, we're back in 90 seconds. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Ballot question two, the proposal to lift the cap on charter schools, is the single most expensively fought ballot question in Massachusetts history. Both sides have raised $33 million so far. That's $3 million more than what was spent on all ballot questions combined in 2014. Well, over the past several weeks, we've been reaching out and requesting interviews with the largest donors on both sides. Proponents of lifting the charter school cap have raised some $21 million so far, and 75% of that is from five nonprofits. By far the largest is New York-based Families for Excellence Schools, which does not have to disclose its donors. They have declined our interview requests, as did several other large individual donors. However, we did hear from one, entrepreneur Chuck Longfield. He donated $100,000 to the Yes on Two side, and we spoke with him on Monday. As for the No side, 99% of the $12 million they've raised so far has come from teachers' unions. The Massachusetts Teachers Association, the American Federation of Teachers, and the National Education Association are the largest. We were hoping to speak with MTA President Barbara Mattaloni, but she was unable to join us this week. However, we did speak with her back in April as the Question 2 debate was getting underway, and you can hear that conversation at radioboston.org. This afternoon, though, we did sit down with the president of the American Federation of Teachers in Massachusetts, Tom Gosnell. He's a longtime member of the Boston Teachers Union, and he got his start teaching Latin, the language, in 1964. And I asked him, I began our conversation by asking him how Boston public schools have changed since then.
The demographics have changed in the city of Boston. There are considerably more minorities in the public schools than there were back in the mid-60s. In addition, the number of students in the schools, you know, has declined since the mid-60s. I would say those are some of the really big changes.
Mm. There is also pretty high demand in Boston for students who are on waiting lists for charter schools. I want to talk with you in more detail in a little bit in terms of the union's opposition to charter schools, but let me just ask you personally, what does it tell you, what does it mean to you that there are so many families on waiting lists, even right here in Boston, for a charter school placement?
Well, first of all, we have to be clear on the waiting list. The state auditor has issued a report, and she says that the 32,000 individuals that are on waiting lists statewide, not just in Boston, is a bogus number. And even now, we cannot find out exactly how many people are on the waiting list.
Well, I believe if I remember correctly, the auditor's report, Suzanne Bump's report, said that the number may be in the more of the 20,000 area. But again, no one could be sure. But it's not an insignificant number. I don't think that there's any debate about that. And I guess what I'm asking you is, the fact that there are any children, any families on waiting lists for charter schools, does that not by definition mean that the Boston public schools are not serving the needs of those families as much as they could or should be?
Well, again, I don't need to repeat what I just said about waiting lists in the Boston public schools. But I think parents who are interested in the education of their children, and I would say all parents are interested in their children's education, they may be applying just for a number of options, whatever those options may be. I strongly suspect that there are students who are on the waiting list who applied for the charter schools who made the choice to go into the public schools but are still on the waiting list of the charter schools.
Mm. Mm. But again, we can't know that.
We don't know that for sure.
Now, one of the reasons why we're speaking with you today is that on the show, we have been reaching out over the past many weeks and months to the groups that are amongst the biggest donors on either side of the Question 2 debate. And it's actually not a very large group of people because, I mean, that's one of the very compelling stories in terms of what's happening in Massachusetts over Question 2. On the Yes on Two side, it's a small group of donors and not-for-profits, some of whom do not have to disclose who their donors are. They're putting in the vast majority of the money for the Yes on Two campaign, pushing or more than $20 million so far. On the No on Two side, more than 99% of the money for the No on Two campaign has come from teachers' unions. the Massachusetts Teachers Association, more than $7.5 million. The American Federation of Teachers, National AFT, $1.2 million. The NEA, $5.4 million. AFT Massachusetts, according to the latest filings we've seen, has donated more than $568,000 to the No on Two campaign. Now, I raise those numbers as context. Why is it that almost 100% of the support for the No on Two campaign is coming just from teachers' unions, and we're not seeing a big flood of money from, you know, parents, families, other groups? It just seems entirely coming from teachers' unions.
I would point out that there are many, many individual contributors to the No on Two campaign. Certainly, the volume in amount is not equal to that of what the teachers' union is contributing, are contributing. But there are many, many individual contributors. Now, the teachers' unions, of course, believe that this is a vital public education issue. I would point out that for American Federation of Teachers Massachusetts, at our convention last year, the members voted a significant dues increase in order to fund the campaign against Question 2. So we believe that it is our members who are actually funding our portion of the campaign against Question 2, and that this was done through a democratic process.
Are there other places in which this money could have been better spent? I mean, on programs that would support the very teachers who are members of these unions in their schools?
Question 2 really threatens the existence of the public school system in Massachusetts, and that's why we're so heavily involved in that. But that is certainly not our only involvement.
Mr. Gosnell, I'm curious, why does this have to be a zero-sum game? Because I feel like either side, the leaders on Yes on Two and No on Two, they speak about this question or the issue of charter schools in terms of it's all or nothing. I mean, you just now, Barbara Mataloni of the MTA on our show earlier this year said that she absolutely opposes any increase in charter schools. There just seems to be a rigidity on both sides that makes any kind of compromise impossible. Why does it have to be that way?
Well, let me point out a little history here. Charter schools were created in the legislation in 1993. In 2010, there was a significant expansion by the legislature in the number of charter schools. It's very important to understand that it has already happened. This one, if it happens, will have a very serious impact on the district schools. I mean, the district schools are already losing substantial amount of money, and a state commission has already issued a report that the district schools are $1 billion underfunded. Should this pass, this would create 12 new charter schools per year for eternity, and the financial impact on the district schools would be massive.
The question of the financial impact is at the heart of the debate over Question 2. You know, we obviously can't come to any particular conclusion here about it. But I want to return to this question about the teachers' union's opposition to Question 2, because on Monday, we spoke with Boston entrepreneur Chuck Longfield. He donated $100,000 to the Yes on 2 campaign. And he also says that he's donated some $1 million to Boston Public Schools over the past 30 years to support technology, teacher training, that kind of thing. And when I talked to him, I asked him about what he thinks was keeping the Boston Public Schools from making some of the changes that he believes are going on in successful charter schools, such as longer school days, more professional development for teachers. And here's what he said.
At the end of the day, everything is sort of collectively bargained in the public schools. And I would say in general, the central administrations aren't always strong enough, you know, to be the other side of the collective bargaining agreements. And so I think it just is hard sometimes.
So put another way, you're saying unions are...
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of impediments to get in the way. But like I said, I spend a lot of time and money in the Boston Public Schools. I'm big fans and I want them to work. But It's going to take time for that. Change comes slowly. But until that happens in Boston, generations of kids are going to those 70 level 3 and level 4 schools.
So Tom Gosnell, Chuck Longfield was being cautious there when I pushed him on it, but I think it's pretty obvious what he was trying to say, that he believes unions are an impediment to progress and innovation in the Boston public schools.
Okay, let me...
In fact, so do many people who are in support of Question 2 also believe this.
Yeah. Massachusetts public school students are number one in the USA. They are number one in the Western world. Every single teacher in the state of Massachusetts works under a collective bargaining agreement.
Those who don't work in charter schools.
Correct. Yes, that's what I'm talking about, the district schools. Alabama and Mississippi, and I have nothing against the teachers or the kids there, but they're at the very bottom. They have zero collective bargaining agreements.
But what about even the struggle to make incremental changes? I mean, Chuck Longfield was talking to us about many charter schools have longer school days, and it took quite a fight in Boston to get longer school days. I mean, it was at the end of 2014 that Boston Public Schools and the teachers union finally reached an agreement to extend the school day by 40 minutes at the cost of some $12.5 million to the city. And that's just one example. An agreement was finally reached, but people look at it and say, it takes so much work. There's such a profound fight even for this one thing, which, many people in the education world see as a no-brainer, that we got to extend the school day a little bit.
Public education takes a lot of work. Let me just say that right off the bat. But I would point out that not only within the Boston public schools, but throughout the entire state, there are huge number of programs that in effect extend the school day for both the students and the teachers. One has to be very careful about saying that, school ends at 2:30 or 3 o'clock, that's the end of the day for the kids. That is absolutely not true. Now, I actually believe the kids are being cheated because I do not believe that we are doing enough for the education of these kids. In Boston, in Lawrence, and Lowell, and Springfield.
Because there is an achievement gap. I mean, Massachusetts, on average, as you're correctly pointing out, does very, very well, but there's an achievement gap within the state.
I call it an opportunity gap. And this is what I think the opportunity gap is. It's more than coincidence that the level five schools and districts in this state are in places where there is a high level of poverty. And I believe the kids in those situations are being cheated.
So Yes on Two supporters would say that those are exactly the districts where charter schools are needed the most, so that students have some kind of opportunity beyond what's available to them in the district to overcome the hurdles put in their way due to things like poverty.
I completely disagree with that. I think those are the arguments for a greater investment of resources into those school districts. And what happens is, dealing with a very small number of students, the charter schools take resources away from the district schools. And quite frankly, government has yet to meet its obligation to these students.
Do you think that the union that you represent, and also the MTA, the NEA, the BTU, that all these unions ought to, no matter what happens with Question 2, ought to be putting additional pressure on the state legislature to update, the foundation budget formula, to update the reimbursement formulas, to do what you're calling for, which is the state needs to do its part?
This happens every year. And personally, I am committed to making sure that it happens next year and the following year.
Question 2 is the most expensively fought ballot question in Massachusetts history. A lot of that money is coming from out of state. But it's not just in terms of the dollars. I feel like this question is more passionately felt by people than almost any other ballot question I have encountered in recent memory. It's dividing friends and neighbors. It's dividing people in the same school district. What does it mean to you that there is so much intense interest and passion and disagreement about Question 2?
Well, I think one of the reasons there is so much passion, and probably the overwhelming reason, is the fact that people do realize how important education is. Number one, economically it's important, and which to me is just as important in a democracy. A well-educated population is very, very important. But teachers and parents now know from experience that the district schools are being terribly underfunded, that they need a lot more resources. That's the experience of these people, and that's very, very important.
Well, Tom Gosnell is president of the American Federation of Teachers of Massachusetts. Thank you so very much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
The view there from the teachers' unions. As a reminder, on Monday, we talked to Boston entrepreneur Chuck Longfield about his $100,000 donation in support of Question 2. You can listen to that conversation at radioboston.org. And as always, let us know what you think. You can do that at our website or on Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.